Good morning. Nope, everyone's doing good today. Another week. Looking forward to the weekend and all that Sunday brings to see what the pastor has for us this weekend. Sure, it'll be enlightening. And today we are in Esther, starting chapter 2. Take the first half, the first two-thirds, I guess. First 14 verses today, and named this one Mordecai, God's man of the hour. Here we're going to meet a man by the name of Mordecai, who's heavily involved in this story, what he was able to accomplish. Would be his cousin, which would be Esther, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So let's start with a prayer. Oh dear Lord, thank you so much. For stories like this to help us to really get to know you and to know that you are in control of all situations. Well, we see here a rather compelling story of how you used a pagan king and a young Jewish woman, probably not exactly following all the things that you would want to see in a young Jewish girl, but that it was for the time and place, it was necessary, and it accomplished a goal. And we praise you and thank you so much for the for your never-ending message of oh, what's the word I'm looking for? You're always in control, Lord, and we give you praise and thanks. In Jesus' name, I pray. Amen. Another one of those tongue-twisting moments, but. This story overall, it really is rather interesting because we're talking about people that are being semi-punished because they defiled God and the land that they were given by God in Israel, and now they're in basically in the penalty box for 70 years. But that during that time frame, to ensure that the Jewish people survived, many things behind the scenes going on. We studied, just finished with Daniel, and studying Dan, I mean Ezekiel, and we're studying Daniel, and now Esther. These are all basically in the same time frame. Esther, as we're going to see here that Mordecai actually was one of the other people that was taken during the same deportation that Daniel was, same time frame actually, and that I'm thinking. Based on the number of years that Esther was a very young girl at the time, maybe a very small child, because we're talking quite a few years from when the original, it's 518 BC we're in right now, and the original deportation we're talking about was 605 BC. So Mordecai is not a pretty old man. He probably actually. Probably he came as a young child, also, and it so this is actually after the children started going back to Israel, this was all taking place. So, because they actually 605 BC, we're going to see that Mordecai came with some of the folks that came with Daniel's group. Here, when we take a look at those verses today. So let's get some verses up here. And as a backdrop, why don't we we'll be talking about the palace a lot today. So particularly the women's quarters, as you can see over in this back area. See, I got my cursor back, so you can see where the women's quarters are, and most likely some parts of it will probably be happening in the throne room. But mostly the women's quarters. So let's get some verses up here. Read my verses. Okay, Esther 2:1. After the After these things, when the wrath of King Artaxerxes was appeased, I remember we left off yesterday, that the king had had issues with his former queen, Queen Vashti, and he basically put her away. This, some would say that she was probably killed, but there's no definite proof in this particular story that that happened, at least that I've seen yet. But that she's been basically let go as the queen, put away, and that she, and we're actually a few years later in this part of the story. Because originally Esther started, and it was 521 BC, and that whole party situation. And now we're in 518 BC. So it's been 3 years since yesterday when we were talking about in chapter one. So now the king is probably getting a little bit lonely about wanting a queen, as we're going to talk a little bit about today, and what in the culture of this time. And what I keep thinking coming to mind is the fact that here we have a people who are taken, you know, from their homeland, taken into captivity, and they're more or less slaves, and unfortunately they don't have a lot of control over their own lives per se. But in it we can see a young lady that. Even though she may have been, had to endure a pagan culture, seemed to have kept her wits about her when it come to her belief in God. At least she stayed moral as much as best she could of the land. As we're going to see here, that the type of pagan type situation that we have in a kingdom like Persia at that time frame was pretty pagan. And they did things that we would find were not conducive to what God commands us. So you got to wonder what it's like. But in this situation, God still used Esther to save his chosen people. So verse 2. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan, the palace, to the house of the women, unto the custody of Hegge, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let these things for purification be given them. And I just pop down, got some verses here to kind of help us with this particular verse. This particular setup was quite quite common in this culture. For the palace typically probably had a harem. And I think that probably through Hollywood, we think of harem as just some big sex slave type of situation. But not necessarily. I did a little research on what it was like to be a woman in a harem during this part of it. And a very similar situation we see in the Bible with Solomon, who also had lots of wives. And take over briefly the 1 Kings 11, 1 through 3, and we'll see this is talking about Solomon. But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Zenonites, the Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. So you can see he had pretty much 1,000 women that were assigned to Solomon's house. But in that time frame, you know, as they said here, those 700 wives, I can't imagine that any one man could even get to know each one of these women personally. And so a lot of this had to do with for political reasons, as we saw in verse 1 here. I want to talk about King Solomon. I'll just go back there real quick. King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, and you can see all these different countries. And it was a technique back then that typically when a king was had a large kingdom, and many people seeked his wisdom because God had blessed him with great wisdom, and that he became quite popular. So a lot of times these other countries around him would offer women to him as like gifts. That was not uncommon then. There's a famous story in the Bible about when the Queen of Sheba came to visit and gave the king all kinds of gold and silver and presents. So that particular process wasn't necessarily foreign to a kingdom like this in this time frame. So we kind of see the same thing over in Shushan with this king. That a lot of these women that were in harems weren't necessarily like people that the king even saw on a regular basis. They were just kind of women of the house. They had lots of different duties. And yes, some of them were actual partners, probably physically. But that typically one woman stood out and became queen. And she would have special honors. But the rest of the women would most likely just be kind of like servants in the palace. And I think Solomon was probably very similar. But get down and we saw over in verse 3, I was talking about the fact that they wanted to point out, keep the women and let their things for purification be given them. And this purification process was pretty lengthy, as we're going to see in this chapter today. And over in, when we get to verse 12, I'll just show it to you here. It's going to tell us what that means. And now, when every maid's turn was come to go into King Xerxes, after that she had been 12 months according to the manner of woman, for so were the days of their purification accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with sweet odors and with other things for their purifying of the women. So that this process was pretty lengthy. You had the process where they appointed princes to go out into the land, gather all the young virgins and bring them back to the capital. And then for about a year, they went through this purification process. And during this whole time, nothing's really happening except that the women are preparing themselves. And we're going to see that the purification process used, the first step was myrrh. And myrrh is a very well-used, I like perfume. And all I can imagine is they applied it to their skin every day. If somebody, I'm sure during this process that they somehow, maybe they had to lose some weight. If they had to lose some weight, they lost some weight. They became more beautiful. That was the whole idea, to make them be more appealing to the king. Because it was a little bit like a contest. And that the woman who was going to ultimately be selected as queen had to be approved, would be brought into the king for just one night, like a single date. And that was her chance to be able to appease the king and in hopes that the king would choose her. So that was the process that basically was going to be going forward. And I thought at this point, I would jump to I got this nice little chart. I put a couple of slides together. I thought it would, I found this reference in a online, some of it kind of explaining the Persian system and how it kind of worked. So I'll just read through it for the sake of the audio version. I got it titled Persian Harem During the Time of Esther. The harem was a tradition with Iranian, Persian dynasties and aristocrat as well. Herodias, he was a famous author and historian from back then, who wrote in the time of Xerxes, testifying that each notable Persian man had several wives and a still larger number of concubines. And concubines and pretty much these women that I'm kind of talking about here. Here's some of the attributes. Well, let me get the verses out of the way. In case you want to see that picture again. That's a picture I had. Just a picture of some girls that they probably spent most of their days just sitting around trying to look beautiful. But we're going to see what their duties were here in the next couple of slides. And some of the some royal and aristocratic women received an arduous education as one attribute. They were taught, some learned such skills as horsemanship and archery, and even participated in hunting. They appeared in public, traveled with their husbands, participated at feasts, held vast estates and workshops, employed large numbers of servants and professional laborers, and at times wielded political power. The chief consort, the wife, who as a rule was the daughter of a Persian prince and the mother of the heir to the throne, controlled the household. So you almost see this like staff, really. These ladies were subject only to the king. Each had her own living quarter, her own revenue and estates, and a large number of servants, which included harem eunuchs and concubines. Now, for the royal harem, including three or more groups of women living in separate dwellings, and first with the ladies of the household. These were legal wives under them, then the queen, who were excluding the queen or the mistress of the noble house. The second group consisted of unmarried princesses and the married ones who lived with their own family. So they might have been married to other men, actually. But they actually lived with their families. The third group of harem women were concubines, beautiful girls bought in slave markets or received as gifts. That's what I was talking about, the gifts part. It was quite common for a king of another country to offer a young girl as a gift to kind of be a good relationship, you know, kind of like during negotiations for trade and things like that. That was one, unfortunately, during this time frame, women were pretty much considered to be more like a commodity or collected from different parts of the empire. We saw this when we were reading Esther 2:2-3, and even captured from rebellious subjects. While still virgins, they were kept and groomed. So these particular young ladies weren't necessarily like sex slaves or anything like that. They were just kind of like worker bees. And probably had a pretty good lifestyle, even if they weren't part of the royal part of the kingdom. So that was a little brief of what a harem is. So now let's go back, let's continue on with the verse. Now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew, and we're going to talk about Mordecai. Mordecai's uncle was the father of Esther. So it basically made Esther and Mordecai cousins, but I'm thinking there was quite an age difference. So he actually adopted her as her own daughter. So he treated her like a daughter. So it sounds to me like there was quite an age gap difference. Now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. I'm always fascinated too that to this day, most Jews know exactly what tribe they're from. I know that I like to follow Amir Sephardi from Israel, and he always comments that he knows that his lineage goes back to the tribe of Judah. And I've heard that from other Jews that know exactly what tribe they're from. So I found it interesting that the Jewish nation has always maintained a good history of what tribe they're from. And so it's interesting that he mentions this, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Okay, and this particular character is actually mentioned in other parts of the Bible. And over in 1 Samuel 9:1-2. Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Binturath, the son of Ephiah, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. And he had a son. So this would probably be the brother of Mordecai, who became Saul and Mordecai might have been brothers. Let me see if I get this right. No, because he was, no, the great-grandfather of Mordecai was Kish. Yeah, great grandfather. So he would be like a nephew to King Saul. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and godly and goodly, and there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the other people. He was very tall. So it's interesting that we got a little connection here to the royal line that succeeded. He wasn't in the Davidic covenant line, but he definitely was in the was part of he was basically a relative of Saul. So I find that rather interesting also. Don't know what you do with it, but I found that interesting tie-in. Esther 2:6. Who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. This here is talking about Jochian is actually just another spelling of the name Jehoiachin. If you're in my other study, I should have grabbed that slide about the kings. I forgot about it. But basically, that during the first deportation, which would have been when Daniel was taken, so was it Mordecai. Who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away was Jochiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So this would have been about 605 BC. And here we are in 518 BC. So that's some 80 something years earlier. So that puts Mordecai here pretty old. It's either that or he was born, because it says here, let's just reread this. Verse 5. Now in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. I'm thinking it was Kish, okay, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jehoiachin, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Okay, so I'm thinking it's Kish, who would be the father, who would be the father of Mordecai, who was carried away in 605 BC, because it was some almost 90 years later. And I don't think that Mordecai was 90 years old, because he's going to be in this story for a while, and it doesn't make it sound like he's that old. So I'm thinking that he was born probably in captivity, away from Jerusalem. He didn't actually ever get to Jerusalem. Now to read that a little bit clearer. But just as a few verses, this Jehoiakim was a contemporary of Daniel. And going into 2 Kings 24, 14, and 15. And he carried away all Jerusalem and all the princes and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives. So this Kish would have been one of those 10,000 captives. And all the craftsmen and smiths, none remained, save the poorest sort of people of the land. He carried away Jehoiachin to Babylon, and the king's mother, and the king's wives, and his officers, and the mighty of the land, those carried he into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. So at some point, this Kish somehow had, when we somehow his son ended up in Shushan, which you saw when I showed you the map. I'll show you the map again. Here's the map. It's not the map I wanted, though. Where's my other map? There's my other map. So you can see the Shushan is a little bit of a distance away from Babylon. I didn't get the measurement, but it doesn't seem too far. Probably a couple of days' travel or so. So also over in 2 Chronicles 36:10, and when the year was expired, King Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon with the goodly vessels of the house of the Lord, and made Zedekiah his brother king over Judah and Jerusalem. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. I threw that verse in there to realize that some of these same captives, as we found out when we studied Ezekiel, did not leave, decided that they liked Babylon, they liked the lifestyle and stuff, so they stayed there. They didn't go back to Jerusalem. But you got to wonder, whatever happened, you can see that at least the folks here were talking about, this story of Esther, that they seemed to stay true to their God, that they, as we'll see going forward, that the only reference to really something very Jewish when it came to the Jewish religion is going to be, they're going to mention fasting. So this particular story doesn't have a lot of great lessons when it comes to God necessarily, but more about moral, how to handle situations where things aren't always as they appear, and that sometimes you're put in a position that you need to be able to step up. I think that probably the thing I would say here is the faith of these people is very strong to try to save the Jewish nation. So all the verses that point to this is over in Jeremiah 24:1. The Lord showed me, and behold, two baskets of figs were set before the temple of the Lord. After that, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away a captive, Jehoiakim, because that's what I remember, the son of Jehoiachin. This is how we know that this name is the same as the other name. As you can see, the son of Jehoiakim, and we know Jehoiachin was the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judea, and the princes of Judea with the carpenters and the smiths from Jerusalem, and had brought them to Babylon. Also in 2 Kings at 24:6, so Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiachin, his son, reigned in his stead. So there is another reference to the name comparison. So back to Esther 2:7. So now we got an idea of where some of the history behind Mordecai. And he brought up... I was still talking about the virgins. I get back where we were at, the virgins being brought to the castle to see about finding a queen for King Hezekiah. Now I got to remember his name, King Xerxes, and he brought up Hadashah, that is Esther. I guess that's her name in a different tongue, his uncle's daughter. See, that's where it gets kind of a little confusing. At first, I was thinking that Mordecai was Esther's uncle, but it's not. Esther was brought up by his uncle's daughter. So that would be Mordecai's uncle, and Esther would be his daughter. But she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, who Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So he, being in the good family man he was, took over and raised Esther. A little bit like how I think it's important when family can step up and help children in their family for whatever reason. I had that same opportunity, and I praise God for it. I thoroughly enjoyed raising my two youngest. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together under Shushan, the palace, to the custody of Haggai, as another word is spelt two different ways. You'll see it pronounced Haggai here, and you'll see it also as Hega, H-E-G-A, without the I. And Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. This is most likely what they call a eunuch. Typically, they were made to where they could no longer father children. Basically, you can kind of imagine what that entailed. A lot of times in these harems, these eunuchs were made so that there was no way that they were ever going to defile the women, and thus they were put in charge of the women. It could be for natural reasons. Maybe they weren't they were born that way, as we I remember reading it somewhere in the Bible. I can't remember where. Or they may have become basically castrated to become unable to father children. That's the 2:9. And the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her the things for purification, with such things as belonged to her and seven maidens. So I guess this Haggai took one look at Esther and said, "Oh, she's special." This is where I think God steps in. You know, sometimes you're thinking there must be thousands of women that from all over. That's why I put that map here. You can imagine how many young virgins there were in a country that size. I'm sure there were many thousands, maybe millions, because again, any young lady, I couldn't help but think about Cinderella, on the famous ball, that all the young ladies were called to the castle to see the prince, and of course Cinderella caught the eye of the prince. But same idea, really, and almost the same storyline, really. Because more or less the same process involved, where the royalty would have some sort of a big party, and in Persia it was similar, except they did it one woman at a time, so it was quite a long process. I can imagine that based on this, that looking at the timeline, believe it or not, when we get to the next chapter. And this is after Esther's already chosen. It's already 8 years later. So it probably took a few years just to choose Esther. I'll kind of take a look at that, but that's probably pretty close. So it's a long process, but so we're going to see here in a minute too that I think Mordecai was being a nervous dad. So anyways, at least the keeper of the women was impressed with her. So he kind of showed her a little favor by getting her the things she needed for purification speedily, means right away. And again, that to me is God stepping in. And just to point out again, which were meant to be given her out of the king's house, finish reading this. And the maid pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her things for purification, with such things as belonged to her and seven maidens. So she got seven maidens to help her to prepare to meet the king, which were meant to be given her out of the king's house, and he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. So he even gave her a better apartment to live in to prepare. And I like to say that's God working in the background. I just wanted to point out that this same person, talking about the name change back in verse 3, you see him as spelt the other way, Hege. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins under Shushan the palace, to the house of women under the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women. Let their things be for purification be given them. So I just wanted to point out that that's the same spelling. It's a different spelling, same person. I couldn't help but think about the fact that she found favor. It wasn't exactly a prison, but she was singled out among many people, somewhat captive because she wasn't allowed to leave. And that, but even though she was there voluntarily, more or less. But Joseph, when he was in prison in Egypt, so I thought I'd point to this, that was in Genesis 39, 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. So kind of a similar idea is that, when you're in God's plan, and I think that's the moral of this story, when you're in God's plan, things work out for the best, and that, not to worry because, God is looking out for you. Okay, over to Esther 2:10. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Now, this has got rather interesting, is that Mordecai, under Mordecai's advice, now he told Esther, he says, now, I'm going to help you to get to see the king, but don't go around spreading around that, you know, that you're Jewish. Leave that kind of, don't spread the word around. And there's some that like to say that's lying, but, you know, there's the old saying, too, that when something is not necessarily an attribute of yours, why share it, you know? I don't think any of us like to share our more negative aspects of our lives right away. It's not that we're lying. We're willing to tell the truth if asked, but that not to be going around spreading it around that you're Jewish. Because again, these particular people, there are definitely people we're going to run into in this story that don't like the Jews. And so, and I think Mordecai knew that and wanted to make sure that she had the best chance possible to be safe and accepted amongst the group. On to Esther 2:11. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. This is a very interesting verse. When I started looking it up, I saw so many different controversies on commentaries. One said that Mordecai lacked faith because he wasn't trusting in God, and he wanted to stick his nose in to know and then try to influence what Esther was doing. I look at it as a nervous dad. Remember, we just talked about the fact that it took almost a year for this whole process, even before she gets to go see the king. And then it could be quite a ways after that. So, you know, if my daughter had was, you know, someplace around the world and I hadn't seen her for 8 or 10 months, I'd be sure curious about how she's doing. And that's how I see this verse, personally. So he kind of wandered around the palace a lot to try to see if he could find out how things were going. And that's what this verse is basically saying, to me, anyways. Now, verse 12. Now, when every maid's turn was come to go into King Xerxes, after that she had been 12 months according to the manner of women, for so were the days of their purification accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet odors, and with other things for the purifying of the women. Like I said, it was basically to try to make them as attractive as possible. What we're going to see here is that, talking about myrrh, myrrh is mentioned quite a bit in the Bible, and it's a type of perfume. We know that Jesus was given myrrh when he was born as a gift. And so just a couple of verses about myrrh, one verse over in Psalms 45:8. All the garments smell of myrrh and aloes and cassia out of the ivory places whereby they have made thee glad. I didn't get any other verses on that. Basically, it was just a nice ointment, very expensive ointment. I believe it. That was part of the reason that it wasn't readily available, so it was quite an honor to even have that as a ointment. And it probably made the skin soft, I'm thinking, maybe. Maybe made the skin glow a little bit, try to make the women look more attractive. Basically makeup. Well, not makeup necessarily, but something to enhance their beauty. So back to Esther 2:13. Then thus came every maiden unto the king, whosoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. So when it was a girl's turn to go visit the king, basically have a date. Not sure what happened in those encounters. Maybe they just talked. Maybe it got, maybe something else was done during that time frame. Don't really know. It doesn't say. We do know that typically within a harem, that there were still virgins, so I don't think it was necessarily always sexual in nature. It was probably more like a first date. Get to know the girl and see if it's somebody that he's going to like. But I do know, too, that typically in a lot of cultures, that a woman that is not a virgin anymore is pretty much destined to not get a husband. And I know that's that for sure of the Jewish nation. And it sounds a little bit like this particular area is that way also, because they only went out looking for virgins. So that I'm pretty sure, I'm thinking that it was against their culture to defile the woman, if particularly if she was of the same nationality, I'm thinking. Whereas if they were slaves or something along that lines, it might be different. And I think that's what the difference between the concubines and the wives and the gentle women of the harem. We did note there in the harem that there was definitely still virgins who were not married, and they didn't necessarily go and see the king, and they just worked in the household. So even though that it could have happened, I don't think it did on a regular basis. That until the actual woman was chosen to be a wife. Now, once they were a wife, that might be a different story. But talking about whose desire was given to her, and that had to do with clothing and stuff to make her look more attractive. I know there's a movie out called Esther, and I really enjoyed it. It was a good movie if you want to go check it out. It's actually on PureFlix, I believe. And in that particular story, it come down to a couple of different women were in the were considered the most beautiful, and one of them, not Esther, but the one of the other ones, had decided to cover her face because she felt like she wasn't pretty enough. That Esther was more beautiful, and so when she went in to see the king, she covered her face so he wouldn't see her, and it was interesting that that became her the reason that the king didn't choose her was because she didn't feel that she was pretty, wasn't desirable enough, and that ultimately is why the king chose Esther, because she didn't cover her face in the storyline. So back to the real Esther. And just over in Proverbs, and another reference to myrrh. In Proverbs 7:17, it says, "I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloe, and cinnamon." So again, it's some sort of a very pleasant smelling perfume that seems to be associated with. I know with Jesus, I think it had to do with burial, where that so that the body would smell better as it decayed, because I know there was frankincense, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and I know there's a meaning behind the three. I know that the gold has to do with his deity. I think frankincense was had to do with his death, and myrrh had to do with something else. And I can't remember off the top of my head. I may check that out because we're not done yet, and find out exactly the uses behind myrrh. But Esther 2:14, in the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women, to the custody of Shagrages, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she was called by name. So basically what this verse is saying is that once the king met each prospective, typically that they would leave the house, and if the king didn't call her by name, that he didn't feel attracted to her, and thus she would be sent to the house where the concubines were kept. And these, I think, are the virgins, the women that ended up being just household staff, and that she would not go on to see the king no more, except that the king was delighted in her and that she was called by name. So if she was called by name, and that meant the king liked her, and that she would be in the running for the for like the final portion of the contest. So I'm going to end it there for today, and then we're going to move into Esther's turn tomorrow, and we'll see what happens there. So let's end with a prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this time to look in your word. And thank you for this, some of the things that we can see about how to handle ourselves when we're in situations that not always conducive, and how to stay true to ourselves and to stay ever mindful. And that in the long run, no matter what our situation, if we look to you, Lord, that we'll always be able to know that you'll be there to protect us and to look out for us. And we give you all the praise and thanks. In Jesus' name I pray, amen. I didn't realize I had talked that long. Okay, sorry. I thought it was only about a half hour. So I will talk to you again tomorrow.